I'm going to start this meeting off with a moment of silence, followed by a piece of prose that we read in Canada called Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. If we could have that moment now. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow. There are 2 days in every week about which we should not worry. 2 days which should be kept free from fear and apprehension. One of these days is yesterday, with its mistakes and cares, its faults and blunders, its aches and pains. Yesterday has passed forever beyond our control. All the money in the world cannot bring back yesterday. We cannot undo a single act we performed. We cannot erase a single word we said. Yesterday is gone. The other day we should not worry about is tomorrow, with its possible adversities, its burdens, its large promise and poor performance. Tomorrow is also beyond our immediate control. Tomorrow's sun will rise, either in splendor or behind a mask of clouds, but it will rise. Until it does, we have no stake in tomorrow, for it is as yet unborn. This leaves only one day, today. Anyone can fight the battles of just one day. It is only when you and I add the burdens of those two awful eternities, yesterday and tomorrow, that we break down. It is not the experience of today that drives us mad. It is remorse or bitterness for something which happened yesterday and the dread of what tomorrow may bring. Let us therefore live but one day at a time. Thanks for letting me be of service. I'll pass it over to Stacy to introduce the speaker.
Thanks so much, Cynthia. Yay, Beth. I've known Beth the longest. I met Beth when I was 3. At the time, she was my grant sponsor. I wasn't aware of the giant that she was then. That was probably a good thing, but, I'm just going to tell this quick story. So my sponsor at the time, we do long distance sponsorship. And so we go to Atlanta for international in 2015 and I meet Beth for the first time. And so Beth's on one side of me and my sponsor's on the other side of me. And it's the flag ceremony, at the international. Okay. And it took me 11 years in the middle of AA to get and stay sober. They're talking like behind the iron curtain, which I still don't really know what that is. You know, there's my age. And they're, you know, they can't assimilate. They can't, there's these countries that it's illegal to own a big book or to talk about God or to do these things. And these people are at this country. And Beth is whispering in my ear of like, oh, they were here last year, but they didn't have a flag. And, you know, and I'm just thinking, I'm just 65,000 people. And I'm having this spiritual experience of like how for granted I have taken Alcoholics Anonymous for so long, you know. And then later in the weekend, we're walking and we're going to get coffee and it's just me and her. And these people stop her and they go, hey, I heard your tape. I know that voice anywhere. I play your tape for this treatment center I work at. And they do, right? And they stop her and she stops and she sits down and she takes a picture and, you know, gives out her phone number. And I'm like, I thought we were going to get coffee because I was like 3. I don't know what we're doing. And it over and over and over. And then later it's just me and her again. And I say, isn't that like annoying? Like, aren't you like, why are these people stopping you? You know, like, aren't you annoyed that you're bugged? Right. Cause it was like a little annoying. And she's like, no, I'm nobody. I'm lucky to be here. Right. And so, you know, I'm so glad that Beth gets to do 12 cause I am still to this day in awe of your walk. So grateful that I get to watch it. This is in a spiritual experience on page 557, what I'm going to read. So most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often friends of the newcomer are aware of the differences long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few moments could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few expectations, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspecting inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essential of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. And with that, I give you Beth.
Thanks, Stacey. Thanks, everybody. Great job, Deb, by the way. That was awesome. My name's Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. And because of the grace of God, the steps and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship and a million other things, including the powerful love of God, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. And it just blows my mind. I wouldn't even have talked to me when I was new. I would have looked at me and said, "You never drank." I mean, I looked at women 4 years sober and I'm thinking, "Your belt matches your shoes, for God's sake. You never drank, you know." but we did. I love doing step 12 because I get to talk about all the steps. It had never really occurred to me until I was sponsoring a woman and we got through step 11. And then she said, "Okay, step 12, we just get a new girl, right?" And I thought, no, there's a lot more to it than that. And that's when it really started to come together for me. And that's why I had Stacy read that excerpt from the appendix to the spiritual experience, because the steps were my path to God. I grew up in a non-threatening church. I grew up believing in God. I wasn't praying when I got here because I didn't want them to know where I was. But I never didn't believe. But what I found out when I got here is I had no idea how to rely on him. I didn't trust him. I knew he's out there somewhere and, you do your thing and I'll do mine and we'll be good. And it wasn't until I came and worked the steps that I found the power of God that Deb was just talking about, that just operates in my life, that still small voice that the longer I'm sober, the more I know I can depend on it. My dad got sober when I was 7. I knew AA existed. I knew AA had to do with not drinking, so AA didn't really interest me much once I was drinking. It took me a long time to really get the whole powerless thing. I don't know if I really got it till after I got sober. I did drive by AA for about 5 years. I wasn't somebody who walked in the door and said, "Oh, good, I'm so glad to be here." I tried everything to stay out of, I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to not drink. I didn't, and I just, the powerless, I remember being in it when I was about 2 months sober. I was in a Big Book meeting and something came up about, I remember saying, "Well, I always knew I was powerless, but I always thought there was some other way I could do it." And of course, anybody sober more than, a week longer than me just kind of smiled and went, "Keep coming back," because I just didn't even get what I had just said. That as soon as I said there's some other way I thought I could do it, the powerless had just gone back out the window. And I'm glad. And at 2 months sober, I remember thinking, is it really God or am I just thinking more positive this time? And, thankfully this other voice just said, "Get real. If thinking positive did it, you would have been sober at 17. There's always been a chorus of voices in my head. It wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that one of them actually got sober, and usually I can keep him in charge of the rest of the committee. But I just tell you one story that should, sum up, was I powerless or not? I had lost custody of my children 3 years before I got sober. And it was because I lost my kids in 1985. So this is like Christmas of 87. And my son's in kindergarten. He's got his little school program. And my mom, who, while I was busy not hurting anybody but me, and her life turned upside down with a 2 a.m. phone call that said, "Come get your grandchildren because, we arrested your daughter." So with no warning, she's a single parent at 51 years old of a 1-year-old and 3-year-old while I'm not hurting anybody but me. So yeah, that mom. So she's coming to pick me up to take me to Robbie's school for his little Christmas thing. At 6 o'clock, and at about, noon or 1 o'clock, I walked up to the bar because it was just, one of those days. I needed to stop my hands from shaking. I was hungover. I'm just going to go get one till I feel better. And by 2 o'clock, I'm looking and I'm starting to try to decide what's worse, not being there when they come get me or maybe being drunk. And for the next 3.5 hours until 5:30, I agonized over what should I do? Do I go to the Christmas thing or do I not? Am I there when they get me or am I not? And I finally decided I should be there. So I'm thinking I sobered up a little. I ran back to the house where I was staying in a friend's attic. And you know, changed my clothes and threw on some perfume, you know, they picked me up and I walked out the door on time. And my mom told me after I got sober that as I walked out the door, my 5-year-old son said, "Oh no," you know? And I mean, that's not something I would have ever wanted to do to those kids. But once I took a drink, the drink was making all of the decisions, you know? And I used to love when Sandy Beach would talk about, you know, that step two just isn't as hard as we think it is. We see this, you know, coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, and the whole, you know, well, power greater than me. And one, you know, somebody said to me, "Beth, you have proved that alcohol is a power greater than you. I mean, you better hope there's one thing out there bigger than alcohol." And that hadn't occurred to me, you know, but it was certainly true that alcohol had made all of my decisions. It decided who was my friend, who wasn't, where I went, where I didn't go, if I worked, where I worked, when I worked. And alcohol was a power greater than me that I turned to in every area of life. If I felt good, I turned to alcohol to celebrate. If I didn't know what to do about something, I turned to alcohol, and 3 drinks later, I intuitively know how to handle the situation that was baffling me half an hour ago. You know, if I'm depressed, I turn to alcohol for comfort and support. And so I have been turning my life over to a power greater than me all of those years anyway, and I just didn't realize it, you know? So it's not such a leap if you're new to think that there's a power greater than you that you can turn your life over to. Bill Wilson wrote a letter to Carl Jung in 1961 because, you know, Carl Jung had treated Roland Hazard, and Roland came back to the United States and, you know, took Evie to the Oxford Group, and Evie, you know, came to Bill, and here we are. But in 1961, it occurred to Bill that he wondered if anybody had ever told Dr. Jung what had happened, because Dr. Jung was in Europe. So he wrote him a letter and told him about Roland and Evie and AA and everything. And Dr. Jung wrote back and said, "You know, I often wondered what happened to Roland." And then he said, "You know, back in my day, we had to be really careful. It just was almost heresy if you were a psychiatrist to tell somebody like, 'Sorry, buddy, I can't help you. You need God.' You know, you just couldn't really say that out loud." But what he said has always stuck with me. He said that, you know, in Latin, the term for alcohol is spiritus and the term for God is spiritus. And he said, so the highest power and the most depraved poison have the same name. And he said that he had just never believed that he thought alcoholics had a thirst for God, you know, and that we tended to, if we're thirsty, you know where we go. And that he didn't think we could resist it without either some kind of religious conversion or what he called the protective wall of human community, which, you know, AA gives us when we walk in the door. If we stay, we are surrounded by people until we can find this relationship with God. And he said, you know, there's a phrase that is spiritus contra spiritum, which means the spirit works against the spirit. And that when we are under the power of alcoholism or alcohol, it blocks us from God. You know, the alcohol almost works against God and blocks us. He said, but by its very nature, that can flip. And that when we are walking with God, the alcohol can't touch us. And that just has fascinated me. I, you know, the longer I'm sober, the more that means to me. Because I, like I said, I turned my life over to a power greater than me from the day I took a drink. It just wasn't God. It was alcohol. So I had just been looking to the wrong spirit, you know, and I fell into a group when I got sober that read the big book and did what it said. And so they pushed me through the steps early. I had done a fourth and fifth step before I was a month sober. And for me, that was necessary because I would not drink every now and then, but my head would be almost to the pillow and everybody would start up in my head. "Yeah, but God, you don't even want your kids. What's wrong with you? Tell somebody that," you know? And so I couldn't quiet that noise. My favorite promise in the book to this day is the one that says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Because from an early age, long before I ever took a drink, I couldn't be alone at perfect peace and ease. I had a chorus of voices in my head from the beginning that told me nobody liked me and everybody was picking me to pieces and they were laughing at me and they were talking about me. And so I would just always stay in the middle of something noisy because the quiet was deafening. And if you have a head like mine, you know what that means. And, you know, so I just kind of pushed on through the steps. And I'm so grateful because I, you know, step three, I was about a year sober and my grandfather had a stroke. And so I flew out to Arkansas where he lived because my dad died when I was in treatment. So I had not really gotten to see my dad. And so I wanted to go out and see my grandfather. And because I was a year sober, I had a credit card. Now it had a whopping $500 limit on it, but I had it, you know, and I had a driver's license and I was able to fly out to Arkansas and stay in the hood. Now my mom paid for the trip. Don't get me wrong. I didn't have any money, but I couldn't even have taken the flight, rented a car, paid for the hotel without the credit card and the license. And I went out to see him and I went to a Noon Big Book meeting in Rogers, Arkansas, and cause that's what I do. I got sober in Noon Big Book in Cincinnati, Ohio. So if there's a Noon Big Book meeting, I go. And I went to this Noon Big Book meeting and they said, hey, come back tonight. You're in for a treat and bring your big book with you. So, you know, I can follow directions. I'm a year sober. I come back that night. I bring my big book. Well, I don't know how many of you heard of Joe and Charlie, but Charlie lived in Maysville, Arkansas, which is not far from Rogers, where my grandfather lived. And apparently about every 2 years, Charlie would come to Rogers because it was kind of close to a tri-state area. And for 8 consecutive Wednesday nights, he would do the Joe and Charlie thing. And I had just wandered into it because A, I went to a new big book meeting because there was one. And B, they said, come back, bring your book. And I did. And Charlie talked about step three that night. And what he said was, you know, step three is a decision. You know, we get so, and I've gotten dizzy in step three meetings where people are like, turn it over, took it back, turn it over, took it back, turn it over, took it back, turn it over, took it back. And, you know, what I kind of understand is we don't, you know, we decide to turn it over. And I had been through treatment 3 times before I got sober and they have these stupid frog on a log, you know, 3 frogs are on a log. One decides to jump off. How many are left? 3. Cause he only decided. Great. What's that got to do with me, you know, personally? So intellectually I could get it, but I just thought it was kind of stupid. And Charlie said, you know, this decision, a decision implies that further action will be taken. And, you know, you can decide all day long. He said, every year I decided that Barbara, his wife, he said, I decided Barbara and I would go on vacation. And every year nothing happened. You know, we'd decide and then nothing would happen. And he said, 1 year we decided to go on vacation. And so we arranged for some time off work. And, you know, we got the car service and we made some hotel reservations and we got some maps and we packed and we put the stuff in the car. And then we, you know, we drove from Arkansas to whatever's my Western geography's bad, but they went west. They were going to San Diego. So, you know, they're in this state and they're in this state and they're in this state and then they're in San Bernardino and then they're in San Diego. And what he said after that struck me because he said, okay, decision was the same as every other year. But this year I'm in San Diego, not as a result of the decision, but as a result of the series of actions that I took after the decision. And that is how step three works. We can decide to turn our will and our life over, but you know, the way that I turn my will and my life over is by working the rest of the steps. And so when Charlie was talking about that, I could look back and say, oh, that was my experience. I mean, yeah, I said a third step prayer with my sponsor, but there wasn't a whole lot of work into it. It was like, do an inventory. You've been around before. You know, if you want to stay, try doing an inventory and, you know, read the book and do what it says. And so, you know, step three is, you know, in its most basic form, step three is deciding to do the rest of the steps. That's all there is to it. You know, there's no, if I could have found God at step three, trust me, I would not have done the other 9 because why would I? You know, if I can get the prize at step three, I'm done. You know, my husband's a social worker and with a master's degree. And he told me one time that I had a type AL personality and I'd heard of type A, but I didn't know what type AL was. And so I asked him like an idiot. Right. And he says, well, I have no doubt that you're type A personality, but you are lazy enough that you're not annoying. And it's true. You know, it's just true. So if I could have got it in 3 steps, why do the other 9? But step three was just deciding to do step 4 and step 5 and step 6. So I wrote the inventory and, you know, people ask me, how long does it take to write an inventory? And I tell them, you know, it's kind of like laundry. It takes 2 or 3 hours, or it takes 2 weeks and 2 or 3 hours, or it takes 6 months and 2 or 3 hours, or it takes 5 months and 2 or 3 hours if you live that long. You know, it is just once you start, it just, it's good. You know what's in it. Just, at least in my case, it just kind of puked itself onto the page, you know? And when I'm out of things, I'm out. I don't have to lock myself in a closet and go over it 12 times and be sure. Now I'm an accountant by trade, and you know, the temptation to do it in Excel on a spreadsheet so the lines would be straight was just almost more than I could bear. But I somehow sensed that would be ego running things. So I drew it crooked lines and all and wrote it by hand, you know, which for me, as Stacy would know, what an act of love that was, because, you know, I could have typed it and it would have been nice and neat. But my life wasn't nice and neat. My life was in wreckage. And I wrote it, and it was for all the things that kept me up at night. You know, I didn't go through one of those 600 question four-step guys, because I have seen them since then, and I'm glad I didn't see one before, because it would have dredged up a whole lot of stuff that I maybe wasn't ready to remember. You know, I firmly believe that we will remember when it's time. You know, God will bring it to me when I can take it. But if I had remembered everything at once, it would have killed me. And so my first four step was for all of those things that kept me up at night. You know, the fact that I didn't want my kids, that I was glad my mom had them, the fear that alcoholism had destroyed any ability to even ever love them, because I just was dead inside when I got here. I had fear, rage, or nothing, numb. That was kind of my skill set in the emotions category. And I did my fifth step with this woman who I had heard tell an entire room full of people that she didn't want to take care of her kids. She just wanted to drink. And you know, when somebody else tells my biggest secret to 200 people on a Friday night at 405 Oak Street, that caught my attention. And I got her phone number and I went, that was the first day out of detox. I went into detox on Friday of 4th of July weekend. And I was like, no, I went into detox on June 26th. I got out on Friday of 4th of July weekend. And I had made arrangements to go into this hotel for women because I knew I couldn't live where I lived without drinking. My car was impounded. I had charges pending. I couldn't do, you know, Friday was July. It was 4th of July weekend, and the 4th was on Monday. So my life was on hold until Tuesday. I couldn't get my car back. I couldn't see what charges were pending. I couldn't get into this stupid hotel for women. And I knew if I went where I lived, I would drink. So I managed to scrape up enough money to just get a super cheap hotel room right on the bus line in Cincinnati that I could just walk out the door, get on the bus, ride it about 4 miles down the road and walk a block to the AA clubhouse. And I almost didn't go the first night because I've been going to meetings all week. I could take a day off. But one voice in my head said, hey, you know, you skipped meetings before and you drank. Maybe you should just go. So I went. I got on the bus and I went. And then here this woman is talking. I had met her when I was passing, driving by 4 years before. And now she's 4 years sober because she stayed. And she tells my biggest secret to a room full of people. So I got her number. And I stayed for the midnight meeting that night. Thank God there was one because I was a bar drinker. And the next morning, do I call her or not? You know, and the committee is in full session. She didn't really want you to call. She's just being nice. She's going to say Beth who, you know, you name it. They're up there talking. And one voice said, you know, you didn't call people before and you drank. Maybe you should just call her. Fine. Right. So of course, back then there's no voicemail, there's no cell phones, there's no nothing, you know, so I finally call her and just my luck, she answers. Right. I mean, I figured I had a 50-50 shot that maybe she wouldn't be there, but no, she answered the phone. And I just said, this is Beth. I got your number last night. I don't have a clue what to say to you. I just know I have to use the phone. And she just laughed and said, that's what I had to do too. And that's what we tell new people now. Just tell us just call me and say, I'm practicing and hang up. That is fine with me. You know, because it really, I mean, there's been so many times over the years I call my sponsor and maybe she's not there. And I feel better just hearing her voice on the answering machine, you know, because I am taking the action. As long as I'm taking those actions, God changes my heart. And that's like the secret recipe to me to all of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard early on that a guy in a meeting said, I really think God gave us AA to just keep us busy and out of his way, so that he can fix our lives. And I tend to believe that, because the more I do Alcoholics Anonymous, the better my life gets in completely unrelated areas. So I did this fourth and fifth step, you know, I asked this chick to hear my inventory and she did. And we kind of blew through 6 and 7 because that's what you do the first time around. It's only a paragraph each in the big book. Yes, you know, And I started to make my amends, and you know, and my life took off. Now I will tell you that around 3 years sober, step 6 and 7 will sneak back up on you. At least they did to me and most people I sponsor. All of a sudden, the depth and weight of what, you know, because the 12 and 12 says that step 6 is what separates the men from the boys. And it's the next big surrender, you know. But what I've realized about step 6 and 7 is that, like, when I got sober, I did not just sit home and hope that God removed the obsession to drink. I mean, did I hope he would? Yes. Did I ask him to? Yes. But I also had all these new behaviors that I did instead of drinking. I called people. I read the big book. I prayed. I went to meetings. You know, I got a sponsor. I called my sponsor. My sponsor knew she was my sponsor. That was kind of a new thing. I always had a sponsor when I was passing through, but she didn't always, you know that she was my sponsor. Cause I never asked her. I would just tell you so you would leave me alone. And, so, you know, but I had all these new behaviors to substitute for drinking, you know, so it was more like distraction. And I have seen that 6 and 7 work the same way. I went to work for my mom when I got sober because I was basically unemployable. She was a CPA and had her own little local practice. And so I worked with her and I, you know, I went to school and got some more skills and everything. But I don't know how long I'm sober, somewhere between 3 and 6. And well, at 3 years sober, this is when step 6 just smacked me in the head. I'm kind of a visual thinker. Those who know me know that. And all of a sudden, one day, a friend of mine is saying, you know, he's like, well, yeah, I know I lie, but I lie to get what I want. So if I stop lying, how do I get what I want? You know, and I know I'm lustful, but if I ask God to take that and he does, what if I never have sex again? You know, and it was like, and so we're all going like, you know, we had not considered that. But all of a sudden, I realized that my character defects were the tools that I used to get what I want. My character defects are what I use to arrange outcome. And the big book says that we have to stop playing God. And I used to have this picture of playing God as kind of being up there with the marionette strings. But what I realized is playing God for me is trying to shape the outcome instead of just doing the action and seeing what happens. And so this whole step 6 thing is rolling around. And all of a sudden I just have this vision of like one of those carpenter tool belts. You know what I mean? And all of my character defects are in it. They're all my tools, you know, lying, manipulating, you know, passive aggressive, all of that, anything. Those are my tools to get what I want. And AA is telling me, like, stop using the tools. Put them back in the belt. Worse, you're not even saying put them back in the belt. You're saying take the tool belt off and lay it down on the floor. But we're not done yet. Take the tool belt off, lay it down on the floor, and then we want you to hold hands with us. God in one hand, AA in the other hand. Now, smarty, when you want to grab one of your tools, which one of us are you going to let go of, God or AA? I'm screwed, you know? It's like I have no choice now but to trust God that I might get what I want. Because I am not, you know, even by 3 years sober, I know I am not letting go of God. I am not letting go of AA to grab out there. And same deal with my stuff. I love my stuff. But, you know, and the better my life has gotten, the more I've done AA. But I got all of that because when I put what I have on, you know, I always kind of pictured a scale. I might have had a home business or two before I got sober. So I had this visual, you know, kind of a scale. And I put everything, you know, AA is my business and the rest of my life is God's business. And when I started doing some meetings, you know, God filled up this other side a little bit. And I go to more meetings and I work some steps and I get a job and I get my driver's license back. And I, you know, I do some more and I get some more and I do some more and I get some more. And somewhere around 6 or 7 years sober, the ego rises again. I remember talking to my sponsor right before I turned 6 because I heard 3 talks in a row where somebody just lost their butt at 6. And I was like, I don't know if I even want to turn 6. And she does, my sponsor, Peg M from Bellevue, Nebraska. And she just goes, oh, yeah, 6 is such an interesting year. The ego rises from the ashes. And it was like, and all of a sudden I thought, because it seemed like a lot of people drank at 7. And I just had this passing thought, like, God, it's not seven that makes them drink. It's that the ego rose at six and they quit doing AA. You know, if I quit doing AA tomorrow, I could probably go a week, a month, a year without taking a drink. But gradually, I will drink again. I don't stay in the middle of the solution. Because if I am not going forward, I'm going backward. So, you know, so now AA is saying, like, hold hands with us. Don't use your tools, you know. And we have another running joke. We just say, you know, character defects never go away. They just go off stage and change costumes. And the longer we're sober, the better their wardrobe gets. It's much more subtle. It's much more refined, but it's all still there. And I think what the 12 and 12 means, you know, one of the things that 12 and 12 says, and those who know me know I don't quote the 12 and 12 a whole lot. So this is, you know, this is important. But it says that, you know, we'll go, well, God, remove the drinking. Why can't he take this other stuff? And A, the drinking was killing you, so it was a little more obvious. But B, it says, you know, God is not going to render us white as snow without our cooperation. And since, you know, what happened getting sober was I took the actions and God changed my heart. You know, I take the same actions now to stay sober that I did when I was new. I have a sponsor. I read the book. I pray. I go to meetings. I work with others. Same stuff 31 years later. But at first, I had to really concentrate on doing it. And then it was kind of a habit. And then I kind of liked it. And now it's a way of life. And step six and seven work the same. You know, I have found the best use of... Sometimes you'll see a list of character defects and the opposites, you know. And so, you know, here's my character defect. Selfish. Okay, so be unselfish. Great. Why didn't I think of that? You know, I mean... I'm a verb girl. I'm not real good with nouns. And so, you know, to me, like saying, oh, you're a selfish alcoholic, just be unselfish is right up there. It's going, oh, you're homeless. Well, just buy a house. You know, I mean, it should be easy. Right. And so I kind of put this together in hindsight. So I was working with mom and it was close to where I lived and the kids lived and everything. And I would be going to lunch and she would say, hey, I may be going home for lunch. And she'd say, oh, on your way back, could you pick me up at Jersey Mike's? And now it wasn't on the way back. Okay. I'm going home for lunch and to Madera, we're in Montgomery and Jersey Mike's is in Blue Ash, not on the way, but I, you know, I would do it because, well, for one, she's my employer, you know? You know, she'd get the eye roll on the body language and here's your sandwich. And one day I just had this passing thought, like, I wonder what a good daughter would do. You know, if you were nice, what would you do? If it was somebody else's mother, what would you say? Cause I literally started with my mom at what would you say if you liked her? Because I laid a lot of my life at her feet. And none of it was her fault, but you know, she's an easy target. And so I'd started out sober with what would you say if you liked her? You know, what would you say if it was Deb's mom or somebody else's mom? And so one day I thought, well, if she asked me to get a sandwich and it was anybody but my mother, what would I say? Or if I was a nice, kind daughter, what would I say? I would probably say, I'd be glad to. What an order, God. I can't go through with it. Right. So I laid the trap. I went in and said, hey, I'm going home for lunch. And right on cue, she says, oh, on your way back, could you get me a Jersey Mike's? And I went, I'd be glad to, through gritted teeth, but I got it out, you know. And when I brought her back the sandwich, I tried to hand it to her with a smile instead of all that you have like inconvenienced me body language. I also have to tell you at this point that from the office to my house to Jersey Mike's back to the office, that big out of the way trip, the entire circle was probably 8 miles. But that's not the point. It was not on the way. So anyway, I start saying I'll be delighted. It got easier. One day I realized I was glad to do it. And then a few weeks later, I heard myself saying to my mother, hey, I'm going out for lunch. Can I bring you a sandwich on the way back? And I thought, where did that come from? You know, and a couple weeks after that, I remembered that she was not a one, but a 2-time lung cancer survivor. We worked in a second floor office. And anytime she didn't have to go up the stairs twice was a good day for her. Now, what changed? You know, did I ask God to take it away? Yes. But I've sat in step six meetings and just it's hard to not laugh out loud sometimes. But, you know, and they probably don't say this where you live. This is probably just Cincinnati and a couple of North Carolina. But, you know, I'll be in a step six meeting and invariably I will hear something like, well, I've been asking God to take it away and he just hasn't yet. So, you know, I get subtext. So I'm still going to be an asshole, you know, because God is slacking clearly because I still don't want to be nice. Right. But what I did, you know, in hindsight was the same as step one. I substituted new behavior for what I would intuitively do. And it was hard. And then it was easier. And then it was a habit. And then I liked it, just like doing all that stuff that step one was, you know, reading the book, calling, blah, blah, blah. And so this is how I walk people I sponsor through step six and seven now, is I don't just have you write a list of your character defects, but I want you to tell me what's it look like when you're doing it. You know, okay, what does selfish look like? How's it manifest in your behavior? You know, arrogance was a big one of mine. What's it look like when I'm being arrogant? Okay, this is what it looked like with my mom. Eyes rolling, body language, interrupting on the phone, you know, slouching in the chair, total disinterest. So what would the opposite of that be? Don't interrupt on the phone. Sit on the edge of my chair and look attentive. Smile and look like I like her. You know, so I have new action to substitute for the old. While I'm doing that, it becomes easier and easier, and then I like it. So the same as getting sober, I take the action, but God changes my heart. Otherwise, it would suck just as bad now to do it as it did 31 years ago. God changes hearts here. But in the meantime, I need to act like he did. If I ask him for help, I need to assume that he has helped me. And that's made a big difference. Also, I find a thesaurus comes in handy with character defects. Somebody I sponsor called me one day, and she had gotten a review from work, and she was really mad because she was expecting a really stellar review, and they told her that she was unapproachable. And she was like, what the heck? Well, that's not what she said, but you know, what does that mean? And I just kind of offhandedly said, well, I don't know. Why don't you look it up? You know, and I promptly forgot about it. And she called me back 10 minutes later, laughing out loud. And she said, oh my God. You know, and I'm going to read it to you because I can't remember them all. So she had gone and looked it up, and all of the other words for unapproachable were aloof, cold, distant, hesitant, inaccessible, you know? And she was dying. She's like, oh my God, I'm all of those, you know, but unapproachable didn't register for her. And so, we did a step six weekend one year where we took the seven deadly sins out of the 12 and 12 and found different words for them. And, you know, different words just bring up different thoughts. So like, you know, when it says greed, you know, there's greedy, but there's also stinginess, selfishness, you know, and what's the opposite of that? Of course, being unselfish, but being honorable, being giving, you know, being charitable. Pride is arrogance, presumption, vanity, you know. So the opposite of pride is humility, modesty, tolerance, gentleness. And so sometimes if I'm trying to look at a character defect and I can't figure out what it is, I can pull out a thesaurus and see all the other. It's kind of like in the inventory in that third column where it says what was affected. I just don't think in those terms of what was affected, you know, like, I don't know. But it also says what was hurt, threatened, or interfered with. And by golly, I can tell you on every one of them what was hurt, threatened, or interfered with. So sometimes just looking at a different word for the same, you know, synonym, it just kind of opens up the way we're thinking about it. The amends process, you know, I made the obvious amends, financial amends, you know, sorry. Of course, I, like everyone else, wanted to go apologize to the cashier that I was rude to and the married guy's wife that, you know, that's why we have sponsors, because generally the amends we want to make are the ones that, you know, I got told that the kindest thing that you could do for some of these people is just leave them alone and never call them again, you know, you know how we are. I thought they'd want to know how great I was doing, you know, like, oh, I'll just call and let them know. But no, a good sponsor would keep you from that. But there were other sponsors, you know, my sponsor calls them living amends sometimes. And I do think at some point living amends kind of cross over into being practicing these principles in all our affairs. But, you know, my first amends to my kids was to make a promise and keep it, you know, to stop making promises I couldn't keep. because I would not show up or, you know, take off or whatever. And then I feel bad and I make all these grand promises, you know, and then of course none of them would ever get kept. And my word was worth nothing when I got sober. And so some of my first amends to my family members was to be where I said I'd be when I said I'd be there, to do what I said I'd do when I said I'd do it, you know, because those were not things that came naturally to me. My dad died while I was in treatment 3 years before I got sober. And when I was a couple months sober, I drove up to Oxford, Ohio, where he had, you know, that's where his home group was. And you know, I got there a little late, so I wasn't there to say out of town or whatever. And toward the end of the meeting, I'd been watching this one guy, and he just kind of sat like my dad, and he smoked like my dad, because they still smoked inside back then. And he held his cot, you know, it was just kind of crazy looking. I mean, physically, they didn't look alike, but the manner was a lot alike. And after the meeting, I went over and just at the very end, he said, "I don't know how many of you remember Jim Kirby, but Jim always said, blah, blah, blah." Well, Jim was my dad. And so after I went over and told him who I was, and they just burst into tears because it turned out my dad had been his sponsor. And what I realized when I, you know, as people found out who I was, you know, my amends to my father was to let his friends know that I was okay, because that's what he would have wanted. You know, any of us with kids, if somebody says, "How's your kids doing?" You know, I mean, I did get custody of my kids back. And a couple of years later, our son became a teenager, at which point we really wondered why we had ever wanted them back. But, you know, that's another story. But, you know, we had a hard time. And if somebody said, "How's Robbie doing?" on any given day, so, you know, sometimes you just don't want to answer. And so really, most of us, what we really want is to just be able to tell kids that tell people our kids are okay. And so my amends to my father was to go up to his home group a couple times a year while I still lived in Cincinnati and see his friends so that they would know I was okay, because that's all he ever wanted. When they say, "How's Beth?" He wanted to say, "She's sober, she's remarried, she's employed, she passed the CPA exam, here's pictures of my grandchildren," you know. And one day the old family doctor just kind of crossed my mind. And so I sat down and wrote him a letter. I was 5 years sober. And I just said, you know, because he'd been my dad's doctor, my grandmother's doctor, little town, you know. And so I wrote him a letter and just said, you know, "It's me, Beth, and I'm remarried. And here's pictures of the kids. And doesn't Robbie look like my dad?" And, you know, you were just on my mind. And, you know, so I sent the letter. And I had a voicemail a couple days later from him. And he said, "You know, I've only saved about 5 letters in my life, but this one's going in my folder. And it's just so good to know that you're alive and you're doing okay. Your dad was always so worried. And, you know, if you're ever in town, please come see me." And 2 months after that, he and his wife were killed in a freak accident in an ice storm. And I just thought, thank God I listened to that voice. You know, I have found over and over and over that when somebody crosses my mind that I haven't thought about in months or weeks or years, I need to either be watching for them or I need to, you know, I need to contact them, because that stuff doesn't come by accident. I, you know, my amends to my mom was to learn how to be a good daughter. You know, my husband's dad was also dead when he got sober. And his sponsor had him read the letter at the gravesite and then burn it. And Chuck just never got the relief from that. And I tell this with permission. But a few years later, he was listening to his speaker, Keith Lewis, talk about his dad and their relationship being restored. And to thank the speaker line, Chuck said, "I really envy you. You know, my dad died before I got sober." And Keith said, "Go stand over there. And we know how to follow directions from an old timer." So he did. And Keith said, "Find someone who reminds you of your dad and ask them to stand in so that you can make an in-person amend." It doesn't have to look like them. Might just, you know, remind you of them, you know, mannerisms or whatever. And Dick Martin happened to be taping the convention. And Chuck's dad was a super principled man. You know, he was just a good family man. And Dick was like that. And so Chuck went and talked to Dick. And Dick said he'd be glad to. And so Chuck said, "Dad." And Dick, like, pushed his glasses up and straightened his tie and said, "Yes, son, what can I do for you?" And the thing is that when Chuck was a kid, and I retell this with permission, if he had something to talk to his dad about, his dad had come home from work, loosened his tie, start reading the paper. And if Chuck went and said, "Dad, you know, can I talk to you?" Chuck's dad would push up his glasses, straighten his tie, and say, "Yes, son, what can I do for you?" And that still gives me goosebumps. But, you know, again, I have had people I sponsor. I sponsored a woman whose mom died, you know, and she had never gotten to make the amend. And it was just like, you'll know when you see her, you know. And somebody came and spoke at our home group, and Debbie was like, "It's her. She's the one." And it took her a year to get up the nerve to ask her. But But she made that amend and she was free like Chuck was, because Chuck had always had a knot in his gut when he thought about his dad. And it just went away after that. You know, I know 10 and 11 have been covered a lot today, so I'm not going to go into them a lot. But, you know, the whole deal is that we've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And the reason I had Stacy read that appendix is because, you know, okay, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. What's that mean? Well, the appendix to the spiritual experience says basically that we believe a spiritual awakening is just becoming aware of the presence of God, you know? And so if becoming aware of the presence of God is a spiritual awakening, then I can substitute that into step 12. And what it says to me is having become aware of the presence of God in my life as the result of these steps. So it tells me I did somewhere between 3 and 12, you know, and step 11 says, you know, continue to, you know, we want to improve this conscious contact with God, which, you know, indicates that we have a conscious contact with God by now. So it's through the working of these steps that this presence of God and the awareness of it has happened. And I was in a big book meeting one day and a girl was talking, and she was probably only 8 weeks sober, you know, and she was saying the first 7 weeks had been awesome and she just been on fire and everything was great. And we had read that chapter that day and we had read the appendix to spiritual experience that day. And one of the other things it says is quite often friends of the newcomer are aware before the newcomer is, that this profound alteration in our reaction to life has changed, you know, the profound alteration change, you know, in our reaction to life has happened and that we never could have done it ourselves. So then she shares and she's 8 weeks sober and the first 7 weeks were awesome. And the eighth week had just been, it had just been horrible all week. And it was a Friday. She said, by this morning, I was in so much pain. I didn't know what to do. So I just got on my knees and I prayed and I came to this meeting. And I almost fell out of my chair when she said it. Because I don't know about you, but at 8 weeks sober, being in that kind of pain and then falling to my knees praying and going to a meeting was not my normal reaction to life. You know what I mean? And she didn't even realize what she had said. So after the meeting, I go running over to her through the book, like, it's working, look, scared the crap out of her, you know, but I showed her what I meant. I'm like, you know, 8 weeks ago, would your normal reaction to pain have been to fall to your knees, pray, and go to a meeting? Absolutely not. So it's already working. Sometimes we just don't know it's working. And so much of my sobriety has been hindsight. Oh, that's what that was. Oh, that's what that was. Deb was talking about it earlier. Oh, that's what that was. So I just have to stick around. There have been so many times in my life when I have just said, I don't get it, God, but I don't want to drink. So I'm just going to go ahead and do this stuff and trust that you will explain it to me sooner or later. And that has happened every time without fail. I had a big thing on my inventory. My sponsor had basically said, what were you doing there? And I thought that was kind of, what do you mean? What was I doing there? I was buying, you know, drugs. And she said, well, duh. And I'm like, no, that was like $2,000. And this cost me $20,000, like $2,000, $20,000, not the same. And she just went, if you hadn't been there, the rest of it couldn't happen. And intellectually, okay. But I just, you know, it wasn't really ringing true to me, but I didn't want to drink. And I remember on my way home saying, God, I don't get it, but I don't want to drink. So I'm just going to, she's been sober longer than me. I'm going to take her word for it. And then trust that you'll explain it to me later. And 2 years later, I'm hearing a fist step from a woman who had been in prison and the guards had given her a hard time because she was, you know, a size 16. She went a size 3 and she towed the line and didn't deserve to be treated that way. And I heard myself say to her, well, what were you doing there? And mine went from here to here. And she said, 2 years. I said, no, I mean, did you just wake up and say, oh, I think I'll go to prison today? Well, no, she had robbed a store. You know, because what the big book says in the right before the inventory, it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. And then it says, you know, sometimes people retaliate, seemingly we didn't do anything to deserve it. But then it says we invariably, which, you know, means always, find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And bingo, there it was. You know, she robbed the store, which later placed her in a position to be harassed by the guards in jail. You know, I'm doing something illegal, which later placed me in a position to lose a ton of money. You know, I could have written a whole notebook on husband number one, but the bottom line is I knew before I ever married him that this was one of the stupider things I'd ever done. And I married him anyway, because it was, you know, well, we didn't really date, but it was looking like I was going to have to move back to Ohio from South Florida. I finally escaped Ohio. And he had a keg party, and I just stayed. You know, we didn't really date. I just stayed. Because it was him or move back to Ohio. What would you do? You know, so, but when it was, you know, inventory time, I realized same thing, decision based on self. I'll just stay here. You know, I can ignore that. I know this is never going to work out deal. I'll just worry about that later because I don't want to go to Ohio. And so everything that followed would not have happened had it not been for that decision based on self. So anyway, you know, I have the spiritual experience as a result of these steps. That's the first piece of step 12. You know, the second piece says, we try to carry this message to alcoholics. What message is that? It doesn't say we try to carry our message. It doesn't say we try to carry a message. You know, it says we try to carry this message. And, you know, what I believe that's referring to is at the end of, you know, the part of how it works that we read at meetings where it says, you know, we made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. That's what this message is, you know. And so I have a responsibility to be sure that if a newcomer comes to my home group, they actually get an AA meeting. You know, I have been to some meetings. I taught a class for a few, well, they call it teaching the class. I like to think of it as a workshop because like teaching etiquette class kind of makes me cringe. But anyway, they would say, well, I would just ask them like some discussion meetings, you know, how many raised by show of hands, how many of you have been to a meeting and felt worse when you left than when you got there? And every hand will go up. How many of you have been to a meeting and when you left, you're not sure you've been to an AA meeting? Show of hands. You know, I have, I see a few hands up here. You know, I've got a responsibility to be sure that they're getting the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a great article called Surrender Not Self. No, God, I don't have I'm in Destin this week and I don't have the stuff I usually have when I do this step. But Surrender Not Self-Improvement, I think was the title of it. But basically this woman had written in and she said, you know, I was working with this new girl, Gilda, and taking her to all the really trendy meetings and great topics and everybody's really on top of their feelings and everything. And you know, because I didn't want her to like, you know, she just wanted to impress her, right? So one night they go to a meeting and the topic is, you know, remembering your last drink or something like that. And so on the way home, I asked Gilda, you know, this woman who wrote the article saying, I asked her what she thought of the meeting and Gilda said, well, you know, it's okay, but I don't really understand what the big deal is, why they're so excited about, you know, not drinking when they wanted to. And so I asked her, well, what do you do when you want to drink? And she goes, I drink. And she goes, she realized that she hadn't taken her anywhere where Gilda would hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were talking about trendy topics and feelings and therapists and all, but there was no AA where she was going. And that, you know, we're a program of surrender, not self-improvement. And I have a responsibility when the choices of an alcoholic are essentially sober, locked up, dead, or, you know, a psych ward. And I take them to meetings where the Alcoholics Anonymous is not being discussed, or I'm sponsoring them and I don't ever suggest that perhaps they might want to work the steps. I have effectively eliminated one of their four choices. You know, they don't even know. They leave thinking AA doesn't work and they don't know that they never did AA. You know, I have a responsibility to let you know that fellowship is awesome. Studying the book is great. If you don't do what the book says, you know, I think Clancy said it better than anybody. He said it is possible to starve to death in a kitchen while studying a cookbook. Bottom line. You know, we have to take the actions in the book. That's the program. That's our path to God. And if we're not doing Alcoholics Anonymous, if I'm not exposing the women I sponsor to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm doing them a tremendous disservice because they think it doesn't work and they don't have a clue they never worked it. Now, have people left thinking I'm not very nice? Yes. You know, I will sleep at night. I would rather hurt your feelings than attend your funeral. You know, I have told women over the years, if you want a friend, get a dog. It doesn't mean that we'll never be friends, but my first responsibility is to be your sponsor. It doesn't. It also doesn't mean that I'm going to be so busy telling you the truth that I'm just going to rip you to shreds and leave you laying there on the floor. The magical thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is, yes, we tell you the truth, and your head might jerk back a little, but then we say, here's our hand. Let's walk through it together to get to the other side. You know, we don't just leave you laying there bleeding on the floor. We walk through it together. And so I suggest to newcomers whenever I can that they aim for literature meetings, preferably a big book meeting and speaker meetings. When I got sober, I did a noon big book meeting every day at noon, cleverly titled Noon Big Book. And then I went to a speaker meeting every night. And I didn't know at the time, again, hindsight told me that I had gone into meetings where you were most likely to hear more of the solution than the problem. Now, that's not to say I also cringe a little when speakers go, I'm not going to talk about drinking because we all know how to do that. You know, if a newcomer has to identify and I talk about spirituality for an hour, I've lost the newcomer. I owe it to them. And that, you know, if that woman hadn't told my biggest secret, which was apparently hers too, to that crowd, I might not have come back the next day. You know, we have to identify. Sometimes us girls especially get so recovered, you can't hardly tell we drank. I'm not particularly proud of the fact that I didn't want my children, but I talk about it because I also know I'm not the only one who didn't want my children. And I don't ever want a girl to leave a meeting where I've been thinking, I don't belong here either. I'm too bad. I didn't even want my kids. And there's almost nowhere that I have ever spoken since I started speaking around that someone hasn't come up to me in tears and said, I didn't want my kids either. And I never told anybody. And I can tell them, you know, now go tell your sponsor. And then if it comes up, talk about it, because there are more, we are everywhere. And it's not that we're bad mom. Well, I was a crappy mom too, but it's that alcoholism kills our ability to care about anything. You know, it just shuts everything down. And, so, you know, my responsibility is to be sure that you're at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting if I'm there, you know, and also, you know, a lot of meetings have greeters, but I got to tell you, I have seen meetings when I first moved here, well, to move to North Carolina, they agree. Well, some meetings didn't. I also learned, like, if you, because like my reflex still is run. If I walk into a new place, it's two groups, all of you and me. And so my committee assesses the situation and says, let's get out of here. So I will just go stand and greet because, you know, if you're new, greet. It gives the illusion of talking to people without any real danger of conversation because they're all on their way to get coffee, you know. But if I will go greet when I want to run, it keeps me there long enough that somebody asked me to read the steps and now I can't leave because how would that look, you know. And then, of course, I feel better when the meeting's over. But I, you know, I have been in big meetings where there's a big gauntlet of greeters. And somebody will come in, get greeted all the way down, and then they stand in the middle of the room not knowing what to do next, and people are just walking by them, talking to their friends. You know, they'll go get coffee, they're talking to their friends, and here's a new person that's trying to maybe get a cup of coffee, and we're oblivious. You know, my home group has an indoor greeter position, too, and that job is to look for the lonely soul in the room. Look for the person who made it through the greeters and then went and sat by themselves because they don't know anybody. And so our floating greeter would go sit down next to them. Are you new here? Did you just move to town? Is this your first time at this meeting? Can I, let me come with me. Let me introduce you to some people. You know, when I put my name on a phone list, I will take the extra minute to circle the meetings where I go and say, cause I don't know about you, but you know, I moved and you get a meeting schedule. It's got a big list of names. You don't have a clue who is who. They hand it to you on their way out the door. You know, and I mean, that's how it looked when I drank, except it was a stack of cocktail napkins with names written on. You know, I had no idea who any of these people were. So if we take just a minute and circle the meetings that we go to inside the meeting schedule and write our name next to it, then I can tell, you know, Sherry, if Sherry's new, hey, you may not remember who Beth is, but at least, you know, if you go to this meeting, you'll see a face you've seen before. And sometimes that's all we need to go back the next time. I mean, when somebody remembered my name, and I spent my whole time going, I don't care what you think of me. I don't care if you like me. But God, I just wanted you to know who I was. And I didn't even know I wanted that. So how can I ask? You know, and I just was lucky that I fell into these people that were at the speaker meetings and at the big book meetings that read it and did what it said. So, you know, we need to carry this message. We need to be sure we know what this message is. There's a reading I like. It's from a non-conference approved source, but it makes a good point. I used to read it at the end of the step 12 talk, but then it was kind of leaving it on a depressing note. So now I try to finish up with a bigger finish. But anyway, this is called The Life-Saving Station. On a dangerous seacoast where shipwrecks often occur, there was once a crude little life-saving station. The building was just a hut, and there was only one boat, but the few devoted members kept constant watch over the sea, and with no thought for themselves, went out day and night, tirelessly searching for the lost. Many lives were saved by this wonderful little station, so it became famous. Some of those who were saved and various others in the surrounding area wanted to become associated with the station and give up their time and money and effort for the support of its work. New boats were bought and new crews trained. The life-saving station grew. Some of the members of the life-saving station were unhappy that the building was so crude and poorly equipped. They felt a more comfortable place should be provided as the first refuge of those saved from the sea. So they replaced the emergency cots with beds and put better furniture in the enlarged building. Now the life-saving station became a popular gathering place for its members. Is any of this sounding familiar yet? They decorated it beautifully, furnished it exquisitely because they used it as sort of a club. Fewer members were now interested in going to sea on life-saving missions, so they hired lifeboat crews to do this work. The life-saving motif still prevailed in the club's decoration, and they had a liturgical lifeboat in the room where initiations were held. About this time, a large ship was wrecked off the coast, and the hired crews brought in boatloads of cold, wet, and half-drowned people. They were dirty and sick and came from all over. The beautiful new club was in chaos. So the property committee immediately had a shower house built outside the clubhouse so victims of shipwreck could be cleaned up before coming inside. At the next meeting, there was a split in the club membership. Most of the members wanted to stop the club's life-saving activities as being unpleasant and a hindrance to the normal social life of the club. Other members insisted upon life-saving as their primary purpose and pointing out they were still called a life-saving station. But they were voted down and told if they wanted to save the lives of all the various kinds of people who were shipwrecked in those waters, they could begin their own life-saving station down the road. So they did. As the years went by, the new station experienced the same changes that had occurred in the old. It evolved into a club. Yet another life-saving station was founded. History continued to repeat itself, and if you visit that seacoast today, you'll find a number of exclusive clubs up and down the shore. Shipwrecks are still frequent in those waters, but most of the people drown. And, you know, I've seen that happen in meetings. I've seen that happen at clubhouses. You know, we got to stay focused on what is the message and are we delivering it, you know? And then the last piece of step 12, practicing these principles in all of my affairs, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm a spiritual giant at the meeting and then I go be a jerk to my family or I'm a horrible employee. You know, some people say they wouldn't put an AA bumper sticker on their car because, you know, they drive so bad. My thing is, I put the sticker on my car because it makes me drive better. You know, I can't in good conscience be honking and waving and drive around somebody and flip them off and cut back in front of them with, like, you know, yay God license plates. It just doesn't feel right. And, you know, or easy does it, you know, screw you, easy does it, you know. I heard a funny joke where somebody is at the traffic light, they had all their God loves you, easy does it stuff on their car, and they're honking and flipping people out and everything. And the cop pulls up behind him and turns his lights on and he walks up. And the person in the car said, I don't know, what was I doing? I didn't do anything wrong. And the cop just said, well, I saw you flipping all everybody off and yelling, and I'm looking at the bumper stickers and I just assumed the car was stolen. So, I got to be sure that I look like I own my own car, you know, but this is where I've learned to show up and be where I said I'd be when I said I'd be there. This is where I've learned. I've been a wife. You know, I met my husband in AA. A lot of you guys know him. He's awesome. July 11th this year, we'll be married 28 years, you know, and we still like each other. We agreed at the beginning that we would have God, then AA, then each other in our lives, that we never wanted to be higher than third in each other's life, because if he's first in my life, God isn't, you know, and vice versa. And I tell him all the time, you know, that on a good day, he is third in my life. If I am not thinking about me, if I'm thinking about me, he's still in the top five. He should be okay with that. But you know, we have a great time. We have continued to do AA together. We have both always been sponsored and never by each other. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous takes precedence over other things we do, because we wouldn't have any of this if we didn't do Alcoholics Anonymous. this is where I learned to be an employee. You know, I'm getting ready to retire June 30th, and I've been at this employer for 16 years, you know, and I actually gave him my note. I'm a CPA, I'm a tax accountant, so I actually last May told him that this June, again, so I think a 13-month notice is adequate, you know. It's been a long, you know, the longest 2 weeks on the planet are the last 2 weeks of a job when you've given notice, because what's he going to do, fire me? You know, that's what my committee says. But I'm trying to show up and do the right thing and do the work. And because I learned how to be an employee here. You know, I learned how to be a parent here. I did learn to love my children. You know, I learned how to be a good daughter. I'm a citizen. I vote. Can't complain if you don't vote. Just saying. It's my opinion, but I'm right. I'm a responsible pet owner. I haven't killed a plant in 3 years. That one took a little longer, you know. But I am, you know, if someone found out, most of the time, if someone found out that I was an Alcoholics Anonymous, they would not go, oh, those AA people. You know what I mean? It's like, we've got to walk the walk while we talk the talk, because, you know, people are watching. One of my old home groups had a sign that said, you may be the only big book someone ever sees. And that's true. You know, if I'm being a jerk here at the grocery store, you're the clerk, and you have let three people ahead of me with 15 items in a 12 item line, and I make you pay when I get up there. And then you walk into a meeting a week later. Do you want what we have? You know, do you want what I have? Or are you going to go like, yeah, you're spiritual, you know? So I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. This was not said by me, but there's really nothing new in AA. And that is, you know, what we do between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer is important, but what we do between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer is even more important. So thank you, everyone. The words I never, ever thought I'd say was, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, but I do. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I never could have dreamed this big before I got here. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. I am amped after listening to that. Oh my goodness. Whew. Floating greeter, brilliant idea. That reading was incredible. Like, so many of the things you said were just exactly what I needed to hear. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much. Wow. Okay. I will end this meeting and then let a few people also thank you. So I won't take up too much time. So we'll have a moment of silence for the still suffering alcoholic, both in and outside of these rooms. Maybe take that moment now. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thy will, not mine, be done. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cynthia. Thanks so much, Beth. Always amazing.
Thanks, Stacey. I just sent you that life-saving station.